everybody. Welcome to Mormon Expression. This is Heather, long time no talk, as I've been mostly over on Mormon Expression Voices. Today I am hosting a conversation with people who have not been on Mormon Expression before as panelists. And our conversation today is going to focus on being excluded from temple weddings due to a variety of reasons. It's a common Mormon problem for people who are getting married. And it's something that has caused a great deal of heartache and strife for people in the church as well as people outside of the church. And we feel it's an important issue to discuss. The first panel member we have on today is Michelle. She grew up on St. Vincent Island in the Caribbean and moved to Canada where she lives now. And she is a disaffected member of the church, or former member of the church, I guess I should say. She no longer believes, but she has children who are being raised LDS. Hello, Michelle.
Hi.
And I also have Insana D. Some of you might know her from her online activities. She's quite a funny lady. Hello, Insana D.
Hi. I'm also known as Dolly Mama on Postmo.
Thank you for letting us know. And I also have with us Truth. She has never been a Mormon. She was raised Catholic, but is not a religious person now and did not raise her family in a religious manner. Hello, Truth.
Hi, Heather.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. All right, so why don't we go ahead and get started on the issue. I'd first like to talk about an interesting historical thing that I don't know that most people know about, and that is that the 1835 section of the Doctrine and Covenants included very strict instructions on how weddings were supposed to be conducted, and it had nothing to do with the temple. So I'll go ahead and read just a tiny little bit of what is found in the 1835 section of the Doctrine and Covenants. Or not the section, the year. This is actually section 101. It says, according to the custom of all civilized nations, marriage is regulated by laws and ceremonies. Therefore, we believe that marriages in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints should be solemnized in a public meeting or feast prepared for that purpose, and that the solemnization should be performed by a presiding high priest, bishop, elder, or priest. So I think it's interesting that it wasn't until the Mormons came out to Utah and were isolated that the issue of getting married in the temple even arose. So this isn't something that has always been with the church, as much as people like to say the church is the same today as it was yesterday, if that makes sense. This section of the Doctrine and Covenants was removed in 1876 after the church had obviously been in Utah since 1947. So I think it's pretty obvious that there was the culture had changed, and since they were isolated, they no longer had to maybe play by the rules of the rest of the country. And since it was removed in 1876, it has never really been a part of the church since then. Nobody really knows that Joseph Smith approved of civil unions in public. And I think if it were known, it might add a little bit of difference to the conversation. But as the church changed, getting married in the temple became kind of the norm. Through the 40s and 50s, at least I know that I've read, it wasn't shameful to get married outside of the temple first. And I'd like Michelle to share what she knows about the 1960 Church Handbook of Instructions.
So in the 1960s, the early 1960s, the Church Handbook of Instructions, it states that permission may be granted to couples who have been married civilly to get married in the temple, but it was through the bishops and the stake presidents. They were the ones who handled that. And there was no fast and set rule that there should be a one-year waiting period if the couple does not get married in the temple first. But in 1968, we're not quite sure if it was a year or two before that this changed, but the 1968 Church Handbook of Instructions clearly states that couples who got married outside of the temple should not be recommended to the temple after that 1 year period had lapsed. And any exceptions to that were to be granted by the first presidency. And so the couple had to appeal to the first presidency to get an exemption to that rule. Whereas before, It was just up to your local bishop, your local stake president, to determine whether or not you were pure enough to be sealed in the temple.
Okay, did I hear you correctly that it said that they had to, if they got married civilly, mm-hmm. if the year had lapsed, meaning if it had gone beyond the 1 year period, that they had to get special permission?
No, if the year, they had to wait until the year had lapsed.
Oh, okay. They had to wait until the year had lapsed. Okay.
And if they wanted to get married any time before that 1 year lapse, they had to get special permission from the first presidency.
Okay. Okay.
Before that, as far as I know, there wasn't a 1 year stipulation. It was just if you choose to get married outside of the temple and, you know, so that your family members could witness your ceremony, that, and then you wanted to get married, in the temple soon after, or who knows how long after, then you had to appeal to your local bishops and your stake presidents, and they would be the ones who would, you know, do your worthiness interview, determine whether or not you were pure enough. So it became a purity issue.
Okay.
Whether or not you were pure enough to go ahead and have that temple marriage be done. It should be noted that Mitt Romney, so this is the Church Handbook of Instructions in 1968 that has the one-year stipulation. And Mitt and Ann Romney were married in 1969. This was a year after the stipulation. And she was a convert. Her mom and dad weren't members. And they actually got married in Bloomsfield Hills in their close to home, not in the temple. And the following day, they both flew to Utah and were married in the temple. So they had a civil ceremony, and then they had it followed by a temple wedding the very next day.
So he must have had some sort of clout that allowed him to appeal to the first presidency and have that stipulation removed then.
Yes, he would have had, and I imagine that Anne Romney, being from a non-member family, you know, she was raised in a civilized nation, mm-hmm. and where the customs, I'm quoting from your original quote here, Heather,
uh-huh.
that you know, it says it's the custom of all civilized nations to have a civil ceremony where family and friends and loved ones can witness it. And that was how she was raised, in that tradition, in that North American tradition. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that she would have had, she would not have thought to not have her family members, her mom and dad, her loved ones, her sisters, her brothers, whoever it was at the time. She would not have thought to exclude them from witnessing one of the most important days of her life.
Right.
Just like most normal people would not even think about doing that.
Right.
And I would imagine too that her family members couldn't have imagined that she would do something like that. And so that's why who knows, maybe they appealed to the first presidency and they were granted that special permission.
Right.
Very quickly, obviously.
Very, very quickly, absolutely.
Like within a day. I always thought that you had to be, a convert had to be a member for a certain length of time before they could be sealed in the temple.
Yes, they do. They have to, a convert has to wait, I think, isn't it the same 1 year? Wait, 1 year?
I thought so.
Yes, I believe so. But we're not sure what date she got baptized. We're not talking about her baptism.
Okay.
She could have been a member for more than a year before her and Nate got married.
Okay.
And so my question is, how can we get that permission? And is the first presidency willing to accept so many requests? Because the church is a worldwide church right now. And they're, you know, it's a missionary church, the proselyting church. They go out and they try and convert people whose family members aren't members at all.
I think that what we see in the 60s is that the church, probably the way it reacts now to liberalism as some sort of mm-hmm. menace that's going to take down the country, take down the world. you know, the end of times. They probably saw that a lot in the 60s. And so it went, you can see in the early 60s, there was the, it's up to the discretion of the local authorities who know the couple and know whether or not they're ready versus.
And it would have been a lot less hassle too, right?
Right. Back to then. Keep, yes.
To keep it local.
Exactly. And so they, I think they sort of developed this policy as a way to like urge, members to, live righteously.
Or in other words, to control your sexuality.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that the church was trying to persuade young people to not follow the freedom, you know, the sexual freedom of the 60s by saying,
"That's right.
Yeah, you need to wait for your temple marriage." And so they kind of used it, the temple marriage as a goal or a tool. And probably by the end of the 60s, it became kind of cemented.
Yes.
I think that there's a darker reality behind all that, and I really think it has to do with the tithing that they can extract. Because if you can control, or if you can manipulate or dominate their sexual side and make them withhold, and then if they sin, you know, and have sex before marriage, then, you know, they get punished, but it kind of works into the whole guilt thing. But for the families involved, if you can keep extracting the tithing from them so that they get the right to go see their children get married, then you've created a business model. And I really think that it has a whole lot more to do with the tithing than even the sexual control.
I think that's definitely what it's become. If you've got let's say a father who doesn't really like paying tithing and who doesn't really know whether or not he believes the church is true, but his 19-year-old daughter's about to get married, you better be sure that he's going to start paying his tithing so he can keep his temple or re-get his temple recommend so he can go to see his daughter get married.
And there's been many instances of that happening.
Yeah, I think it used to be. Yeah, I've always heard about men who have been, quote, quickly cleaned up so they can, you know, baptize their children or give the priesthood to their sons. And I think up to until very recently, maybe, that the same thing was being done with temple recommends, you know, well, pay your tithing for the next few months consistently, and we'll make sure you have your temple recommends so you can go to your kid's wedding, type of a thing.
It's the Mormon version of paying for indulgences.
When you put that in layman's term, it's bribery.
Yeah. Extortion.
The extortion.
Yeah. It's extortion at its finest.
Absolutely. You are using your children and your family. They're holding them ransom, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of people will pay that ransom when it comes right down to it, because you're made to feel that you're the victim, but you're made to feel that it's your fault. It's your fault that you're not in line. It's your fault that you're not worthy enough to be here on this important day of your child's life. And so you either shape up, or you shape up, pay up, so you can be here, or you get left out. So it's a cruel reality for a lot of people that's happening right now. It should not be happening. It should not even be an issue. Like, why are we here, sitting here in 2012, talking about whether or not you're allowed to go witness as a parent? Whether or not you're allowed to witness your child's marriage.
Interestingly enough, though, Michelle, I mean, you're talking about people who were Mormons who have become inactive or whatever. When it comes to a convert, that a parent, we can't even pay the extortion money to be able to see our child get married.
You can't. You can't understand it. And you don't. The thing is that, you know, a lot of people say, okay, my child's, you know, he's investigating Mormonism and thinking of joining, and, you know, I tell them, oh, do what's right for you, but they don't know all of the underbelly. They don't know all of the rules. They don't know all of the tight restrictions, you know.
No, I didn't.
they didn't know everything that's involved. And a lot of times their children don't know everything that's involved because there's no full disclosure. It's you're given, like they say, you're given line upon line, precept upon precept, you know, hook, line, sink, and then they sink and then sinker. And it's a gradual thing because you're expected to commit. Are you willing to, before you know what's involved? And that's how the whole process works.
I grew up in the church. I was born in the 60s and grew up in the church through the 60s and 70s. And it was really very much a different church than it presently is. But the temples were, there weren't very many if you didn't live in Utah or southern Idaho. And they were quite a ways apart. And a lot of people couldn't afford to go to the temple.
And so it didn't matter anyway.
Well, when I was a kid, to go to the temple was something you only did maybe 2 to 3 times in a lifetime. Mm-hmm. Because when we lived in Oregon, the closest temple was Oakland. And it was a 2-day trip to go down there and back at least. Mm-hmm. And it was something that they only got to do maybe, you know, once or twice in their youth for baptisms for the dead and then when they got married. And a lot of people couldn't afford to go when they got married. So they had a civil wedding and then, you know, after the kids were a little bit older or whatever, then eventually they'd all make the trip and it would be part of a family vacation or something to go and be sealed together. And that was really a very common thing. So people had regular civil weddings and ceremonies right in the church building, and the ward would come and it was fun. And it was a family event that was really very special, and we always kind of hoped, oh, well, someday maybe they'll get to go to the temple. And it was more almost an anomaly if you lived in the mission field for people to be married and sealed in the temple. But then as they started building more and more temples, then they started enforcing these rules harder and harder until you couldn't get married until you first married in the temple. And then it became, you know, now they have the McTemples everywhere that just kind of are like a fancy steak center looking building, but they, you know, they build them even when they're hardly used, like in Palmyra. You have to make an appointment to use the temple there because it doesn't get used enough to justify leaving it open. But now, you know, you even in most places in the U.S., you don't have to travel more than a couple of hours to go to a temple, an LDS temple.
And so that those dynamics have changed, whereas before it was quite acceptable, quite common for you, this is what you're saying in Santa, for you to get married civilly and wait 5 years, 10 years to get married until you're able to afford or to travel that distance. And so the church has to realize that, look, we have way more temples that are more accessible to Mormons. That means that there are more and more people that are going to get left out. There are more and more people that can get married in the temple because there's one that's close by.
So,
so this policy that they have in North America needs to change so that it's more family friendly.
So, we're all talking about this as disaffected LDS people rather than believers. I think we ought to explain what a believer's take would be on this policy and their response to people having a problem with it.
May I tell what happened when I first got married in the temple?
Go for it.
When I was a believer?
Sure.
I had gotten pregnant before I got married to my ex, and so we were married civilly in the bishop's office. And I'm sure it was a big disappointment to my family and such. But when we'd been married a year, we went through the temple prep classes to get sealed in the temple. And I remember telling my mother-in-law at the time, who was not LDS, that my civil wedding was not my real wedding. Mm-hmm. It was just a you know, kind of a ceremony of a little dog bone that we threw at the non-LDS family until we could get really married. And I remember thinking that that was, you know, an appropriate attitude at the time, but in retrospect, I'm really completely mortified that I was such an arrogant little jerk to say such a smarmy, unfriendly, heartless thing about my marriage to their son, that it wasn't a real wedding.
And that mindset in Santa comes from the fact that in Mormonism we're taught that any ordinance that's performed by somebody that does not have the Mormon priesthood is null and void.
Yeah.
In the eyes of God. And so that's where that mindset comes from. That's why we baptize people who have already been baptized in other religions in the Mormon,
When I hear a present LDS person say something mm-hmm. that's rather heartless and callous and thoughtless, mm-hmm. without any awareness of how heartless and callous and thoughtless they are, mm-hmm. I remember back to how mm-hmm. thoughtless and callous I was as a Mormon.
But you thought you were doing the right thing, and you thought you were being...
Well, yeah, I actually was never conditioned to believe anything outside of that perspective, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. I couldn't even empathize with people that were suffering from the choices that Mormons made that impacted their lives. And I know a lot of LDS people presently would never outwardly even think that they were being mean or rude or cruel, but many of them are very, very heartless in this particular issue. No idea that they're hurting other people.
I think it's that believers have developed the attitude that to do any, there's even a stigma against having a civil ceremony at the same time on the same day of you getting sealed. Even if you don't sign any, you know, marriage certificate or anything, if you just have like a ring ceremony, that's also looked down on. And I think that the church has developed a really strong or strict culture of you don't value this ordinance unless you do it exactly this way. And I think people who want to do the right thing and who also believe that this is the most important ordinance that they can make for their marriage, they buy it without, I don't know, critically thinking about it. Maybe I'm not sure.
You're not conditioned to think otherwise. You're conditioned from the time you start singing the songs, you know, that you want to get married in the temple. I'd love to see the temple and go in there someday. It's a one track mindset. Anything outside of that realm, you're not conditioned to think about critically, to think about it logically. And so, like when I got married, for example, I was married in Southern Alberta, in Canada, in the Cardston Temple, thousands of miles away from home. And my sister, my older sister, was the only family member who could afford to travel all that distance to be there on my wedding day. And I did not even think twice about, I didn't even think about having a ring ceremony outside. I didn't even think about having a civil wedding. I was getting married in the temple. That's what I had been trained and taught to do. My husband didn't even think twice about it. Nothing was mentioned about, not a word. This was how it was going to be. This was what the prophets told me to do. I was going to do the right thing. This is what God, the Mormon God, wanted me to do, and I was going to do it.
Do you know what I remember kind of in an overt way being taught about? I was kind of conditioned to believe that Mormons were so special, so tuned into God, that they had a much better intellectual or spiritual connection. And therefore, when people were offended or hurt by some of these policies and rules and rituals, it was because they just weren't advanced enough spiritually to absorb the value of it all. And so, as Mormons, we were kind of an elitist, ethnocentric or whatever idea that we were better, therefore it was okay to hurt people.
You know, I keep cringing because while I don't disagree with you, I know that there are many believers out there who would feel that we are not giving an accurate representation of how they see this issue. And I don't know, since I'm no longer a believer, I kind of can't put myself in that headspace anymore. And I don't know exactly how they would respond to this, or how they would say that they view this issue.
Back when my daughter was engaged and I found out accidentally, as they lied to me at my own table, and then my future son-in-law had the audacity to tell me I wasn't worthy to be at their wedding, I reacted from a place of hurt and everything. However, now that I have more knowledge, because when I joined Post-Mormon and I found out more about this organization, I don't even call it a religion. In my mind, it's an organization. I now can understand better what his words meant. I don't believe he meant them to hurt me. They did hurt me, but I don't think that was his intent. Again, I think it's because of what you have all been talking about, is you've been told this for so long in your life, you're brainwashed to believe that this is the ultimate, that I don't think he could actually separate it and realize he was marrying my daughter. If I wasn't worthy to be at their wedding, that didn't make a lot of sense, since I was worthy enough in his God's eyes to give birth to this person that he was about to marry.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lack of empathy for the outsider, for lack of a better term. I think a believer would probably say right now that getting married in the temple is so important, being sealed for time and all eternity is so important, that this is a sacrifice, as sad as it is, this is a sacrifice that must be made for that ordinance. And I think that that idea kind of lets people off the hook for considering the impact that that decision is going to have. I also think that a lot of believers have also been inculcated with the idea, I don't know if any of you guys have heard this, but I've heard this urban legend that, you know, there's some girl who's going to be married. She's joined the church and she's marrying a Mormon, and her parents can't go, but her parents say to her outside of the temple, it's okay, we wouldn't believe you were as dedicated to your religion as we think you are if you weren't willing to make this sacrifice. And I'm willing to accept you doing this because it's so important to you, kind of a thing. So I think that not only is there a lack of understanding of what is happening or what is being done to the outsider or the people who can't go to the temple wedding, but there's also, they've been also kind of fed the idea that if they really loved you, they would understand and they would support you and not be upset and not make this a fight at your wedding. Does that make sense?
And that comes from a lack of awareness of what is actually happening.
Correct.
It's a lack of awareness that you just can't say, wait a minute, you know, my daughter or my son has just joined a religion that is letting me sit out on the most important day of her life. At that point, I would be going, maybe we should reconsider. Your religion should not, on such a really, it's a really a, when we think of it, it's a trite issue. You know, your religion should not require or demand that you make a choice between your church and your family.
I think what, for me, being the outsider, the confusion of this particular organization is it talks about family first, and weddings are supposed to bring families together. Mm-hmm. From the two sides so that they can connect and support this couple in their journey to start their life together. And it's really hard to be able, if not impossible, to come together when you're being excluded and separated on that most important day, which is when they have their vows and they promise before, you know, God and society and all the people there to support them in this marriage. But if you're not there to witness those words and to see them come together, how can you, you know, you're not part of it. You start off right off the get-go being excluded.
Yeah. Being told that you're not worthy. Being told that you're, you know.
Absolutely. You're not a part of this. You don't exist. So I think that's where that sets it up to be, that if the marriage can survive and the families can stay together with that kind of a starting point, I think that it's absolutely amazing, because it's off to a bad start right from the get-go.
And that's not the only thing, too. You know, like, it's sure, it might start off like that, and there might be a parent who would be understanding, okay, this is your choice, this is your day, we're not going to make an issue about not being there. But then what happens to the grandkids?
Mm-hmm.
Right? The grandkids are going to get up. And so pretty soon, it won't take very long for you to realize, wait a minute, I get to miss another wedding.
Mm-hmm.
While the other set of grandparents who are Mormon, they get to go witness it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? While friends and neighbors, some people that this couple probably don't even know, they're there, but you're not. And there's really something not quite right about that.
So we've discussed maybe why this policy has come about, and we've discussed mm-hmm. the impact of it and the hardships that it causes families. Now I want to kind of switch gears and talk about the temple wedding petition, or maybe we should say at this point, since the petition's already been delivered, that the movement or the effort to try to change this policy, because this is just a policy. This is not a problem in some places in the world, because the governments of different countries have said your marriage must take place in a specific way, and whether that be in public or performed by a government official. In those places, there is no one-year waiting period, and couples often get married in the temple very shortly after their civil marriage.
Yes.
And there seems to be no issue in those places. You know what I mean? Like, there's no... I don't see... Go ahead.
That's right. There's no issue in those places because the church has to comply with something that the government has legislated. And it's interesting that in a lot of cases, the church complies with what the government has legislated. The church is forced, in a lot of ways, in this case, to be ethical and to be responsible. And in a lot of cases, unless the church is legislated or forced to be responsible to families and to be responsible to fostering goodwill and to be responsible to relationships, unless it's forced to do that, then it takes another route, which is what has happened in North America.
Right. The church has the freedom to set up its own rules, and so it's in those places that this policy has been imposed.
So their God is selective, is he?
I don't think they think through it that far.
No, but I mean, when you really stop and think about it, if the rules are different for different countries, then they can't be that important to whoever it is that they say is the head, the prophet, the God, the whatever it is, cannot be all that almighty and important, or they wouldn't be bending to any of the country's rules.
I have a feeling that a believer would respond to that and saying, well, I think they would view it as just an unfortunate circumstance of the world that we live in, that it's just too bad that in some countries, couples can't get married in the temple like they should be allowed to. They'd probably even view it as maybe a religious oppression problem.
Well, I say just follow the money.
There's a difference.
The money, because it's really all about tithing extraction.
I completely agree with you.
That's a huge big part of it.
I completely agree with you and Santa, but I think that there's a difference between what the Church Inc. is doing and what, like, believers in the pews believe about how things are run.
That's right. There's a big discrepancy there.
Yeah.
Believers in the pews are largely unaware
mm-hmm.
of what's happening.
So, really
because
quick,
you're not allowed to talk about it.
Of course. Let's really quickly talk about the fears about changing this policy. What people believe might be a repercussion of not having this policy, the one-year waiting period in place.
Well, you know, one of the fears I know, people think that, okay, so now there's not that restriction anymore. There's not that one-year waiting period anymore. So young people who are going to go out and they're going to have sex before marriage. I know that's a fear. But then you have to think, you know, have you not given them sufficient moral compass that they'll be able to still follow the prophet and you know, and remain pure until marriage? Then you're not given, then you won't be giving them enough credit.
I agree.
I have a question then. If somebody gets married civilly, and they have to wait that 1 year. Can they not have sex within that year because they haven't been married in order to be pure, to be married in a Mormon temple?
No, they can. The Mormon Church recognizes weddings performed outside of the church.
But I guess that's where this unpureness, and I'm a little confused, is
the argument doesn't hold, does it, truth? That's what you're saying, is that the argument doesn't hold about the
purity
issue. Yes. So that's, you asked, you know, what are some of the reasons that believers would be opposed to having the 1 year waiting period? And so we decided that argument about the purity issue doesn't hold.
I have a feeling, though, that that could be handled by saying that you have to still sufficiently repent for those sins, you know, because getting married in the temple or not, having sex before marriage is still considered a sin. And so they could just say, well, you have to have sufficiently repented for these things. I think one of the biggest fears that I've heard is that they're worried that people will not hold temple ceilings in high enough regard, that they'll see it as something, man, we can get it done later, no big deal, rather than something very important and very serious that they should want to do as soon as possible. And I think the response to that goes back to what Michelle said about the fears of premarital sex, and that have you not taught these people well enough to value temple covenants? Why is there such a fear in giving them their agency to make their own choices, which is supposedly the Savior's plan, right?
And it's I think that's an unreasonable fear. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's pounded, like I said, it's pounded into us about how important a temple ceiling is. And within Mormonism, there's this huge superstructure that's built up to support those beliefs. And there's a huge pressure that comes into play. And so even if somebody were to get married civilly, they would have all those reminders, this huge superstructure in place that's going to point them to the temple within weeks.
Not to mention
of having a civil marriage.
Not to mention the fear stories that are fed to people about, you know, Jack and Jill got married and on their way to their reception they got in a horrible car wreck and Jack died, and oh, now they're not sealed and, you know, their marriage is over.
There again we have the temple where they can be sealed. Mm-hmm. Their marriage isn't over. So I know some people will say, oh, their marriage is over, but don't you believe in posthumous sealings?
It can
still be done.
Well, right? I think the way I was brought up was to believe that if you had the opportunity to take that ordinance out in this life and you didn't, your opportunity is now gone.
And that's, again, fear-mongering.
Oh, I would agree.
That's a tactic to get you to do. We're going to tell you all these things to get you to do what we want you to do.
Right.
And it should not, that's, you know, that's a tool that's used by a lot of religions, right?
To say that.
Yes, it's a tool, whether or not it's that you won't have so many wives, or, you know, you won't be exalted to this level, this kingdom, or you won't be with your family forever, you know, or you'd have this waiting period before you're actually able to see them in the next life. Like it's all, and they're told to you at the time by these authority figures, and you're sitting there and you're not thinking critically because the fear has already set in. When fear sets in, you're thinking you don't think things through. Things become bigger than they actually are. And at that point, you're not looking for solutions. You're just looking, you're in survival mode. You just want to do what's necessary so that all these other things don't happen.
Plus the fact that, from what I gather, a lot of these are returning missionaries about to get married, and they want to get married as soon as possible, not because they necessarily want to get married, but they don't want to sin.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely a larger problem in LDS marriage culture. I totally agree. And, you know, for some reason, I keep feeling the need, while I completely agree with what you guys are saying, because I am, you know, a non-believer, and I do believe in, I do agree that, you know, that fear is used to generate certain responses and things like that. I feel, for some reason, to bring balance to the discussion by kind of representing what a believer would say who does not have, you know, malice in their heart, I guess, for lack of a better term, towards, you know, towards this issue, or they're not, you know, insensitive to the issue. I think they would say that they're not fear programming you. They are trying to show you how serious the situation is and how dire the consequences are and why it's so important to hold to the rod and that, you know, stay on that narrow path to heaven, because you know that that's part of having a belief system that belief system is the one true church or the one true way, is that there is one path that gets you there and everything else leads you to the great and spacious building or the dark paths.
And to that, Heather, you know what, and I would say, and I completely understand the believer's perspective because I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, when you are being manipulated and when all of these tools and tactics are being used on you, it's very hard for you to see the big picture. You don't realize what's happening. It takes an outsider, or it takes you to step away from the situation to be able to pinpoint and think, wait a minute, you know, this is what was happening here. Mm-hmm. I was being manipulated. This was being used against me. This was being used against me to elicit a certain response.
Right.
And so, you know, sure, like a believer will say, oh, fear is not being used against us. We're taught this way. This is what we're taught. But you don't realize that what you are taught and what your actions are, they're completely contrary to each other. You're taught to be family oriented. You're taught to be kind. You're taught to be loving. But yet you can say all these things that are callous, that are insensitive, without real, and in your mindset, you're thinking, I'm being helpful. I'm doing this to help you. I'm doing this to help me.
As much as it hurts, this is the truth.
This is the truth.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So let's really quickly talk about what the benefits would be of removing this policy and allowing people to, and removing the stigma of having a civil ceremony and having your sealing separate from your wedding.
Truth mentioned earlier that it's a time when, you know, it's supposed to bring families together. It's the starting point for a new unit. And it's important to have both sides of the family to hold that couple up and to support them from the get-go in that union, so that, you know, so that it gives it a better chance to last. And that's one benefit there, is that it starts off on a great, it's a great send-off.
Well, I also think that, I don't think anybody ever thinks of it this way, but I think it could be sold to believers as, and I don't mean that in the shiesty way. I mean that in the let me convince you of my point of view way. It could be sold to believers as being a missionary tool, because what might not occur to people is that the policy that as it exists now is an anti-missionary tool. It builds up resentment towards the church. It doesn't soften people's hearts towards the church.
Correct.
Because, yes.
Correct. They would not have converted me. However, I agree that it's an anti-missionary as opposed to a pro, because if it really was a wonderful organization or religion to belong to, and you were included in, the outsider was included in, there would be more chance of being able to get them to join.
There'd be more goodwill.
Definitely. There would be definitely more goodwill between non-believers and, well, it wouldn't even really be an issue.
No.
I think as a business model, it would hurt the church, because they rely so much on what I would call extorted funds for tithing, you know, by holding that carrot out for families. But I think for young women who dream of a beautiful wedding, it would be really nice, because I hate to say it, but the temple weddings are like an automatic car wash. When the Salt Lake Temple can brag that they do 168 in a day, you're moved through like cattle through a processing plant. And to be able to have a civil ceremony where you get to call the shots and do what you want and have the people that you love and the flowers that you love and the dress that you love is a little girl's dream. And I know so many young women who have been so blown away, disappointed when they got into the temple and found out that they had to sew sleeves on their dress or not even be able to wear their dress. And all these things that make the temple experience as a wedding itself extremely rote and impersonal. And, you know, there's the lofty ideals that you're sealed and stare across the altar at your spouse. But that temple guy, given the ceremony, doesn't know you from Adam usually, and he's just rambling his own stuff. It has absolutely nothing to do with the couple. It's just fill in your name here. And I think it'd be really nice for young women for their dream day to have something personal.
You know, I completely agree with you and Santa. And when I was mentioning the worry of the church that people won't take their temple covenants as seriously as they should if they didn't have that requirement hanging over their head of the 1 year waiting period. While my response is, well, haven't you trained them or haven't you taught them well enough to value their temple covenants? At the same time, I think that it is a valid fear of the church if the people going through temple weddings knew what they were in store for, what was in store for them. If young women who were getting married knew what that experience would be like, they probably would put more, they would have a better, greater preference to have a civil ceremony and do the sealing later. But since by and large, people who are getting married in the temple don't have any idea what that is going to be like, it isn't necessarily a functional concern, for lack of a better word.
Well, they may not have known in the past what's going to happen, but now with the internet, they can certainly find out real fast, can't they?
They could if they were, if they had the inclination to do so. However, I don't have... Go ahead.
Most people are told that you're told to shy away from that.
Yeah, it's considered.
Any information that you're going to get about the temple as a faithful Mormon is going to come from your leaders, and it's not going to be much. It's going to be told in words that you don't understand, or that just glosses over it, or that's just a diversion. And you really have no idea what it's going to be like until you're actually going through it. You have no concept of what to expect.
Unless you have gone out against the counsel of your leaders and found out through other sources what the experience will be like.
Yes. That's right. And most people aren't going to do that, because a lot of Mormons, when you're a faithful Mormon, you have no idea that there's this other world out there, that there's all this information, that you can actually get information about your own religion from other sources. Mm-hmm. You know,
I think a lot of young people are not even aware that there's choice. I didn't know to ask questions. In fact, I'd been taught to fear everything that was outside of that little limited box. And so I didn't even think about, okay, what do other people experience in their wedding? Mm-hmm. I thought, okay, the ultimate goal is to get married in the temple, the most beautiful building in the whole wide world, until you go out outside of Utah and find out there's gorgeous buildings all over the world. And just as stunning of cathedrals and, you know, a state courthouse or whatever is a gorgeous building, but a lot of LDS kids don't get, they've been fed mac and cheese, and they have no idea what steak really tastes like.
Well, it'd be interesting though for a I've never had this conversation with my daughter to find out exactly how she felt when she went through, but given the fact she was not raised Mormon, and she was at, you know, Catholic weddings and United weddings and various other weddings, and saw, was part of the, you know, the planning of them. And because I sewed a lot back then, that she would know that this, what she was going through in the temple, was not, you know, quote unquote, normal wedding.
I think a believer's take on that would be that the focus should not be on the pomp and circumstance, but rather the solemnity of the covenant that's being made to be with the person that you love for eternity. I think that believers are, they put their focus of importance there. And, I think it's probably a minority of people who allow themselves to think about what their wedding would have been like if they hadn't gone through the temple, or to think about what they missed out on in their ceremony since they didn't go through the temple, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
I think that, I don't know that I've ever heard a believer show or express, dissatisfaction with their temple wedding, but I've heard a lot of disaffected people express dissatisfaction with what their wedding was. And I don't know if it's silenced or if they just don't think about it.
Well, they don't think about it because I think somebody mentioned earlier that you don't know that there are options.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that there's music and dancing and beautiful colors and everything else outside of what you've been taught. And so you have nothing to compare it to.
Right.
And a lot of disaffected members, you know, like you could be a Mormon and not have attended a wedding of somebody else who's not a Mormon your entire life. All the weddings that you could go to have been Mormon weddings.
But that's
all you see. And so I think with a lot of disaffected members, they get out and they start seeing, oh, you know, I could have had this. It could have been like this. And you start seeing how really impersonal it was. Like somebody said earlier, a sealer who doesn't know you from Adam. You know, and people there, like I remember looking around the room, And all of the people at my wedding, I had met once, twice. All the people that were witnessing me get married, I had only met a couple of times, you know, or spoken to them over the phone a couple of times. And it was just so impersonal. My best friend that I grew up with wasn't there. Why was she going to fly all that way just to be at my reception? You know, and so I didn't put any emphasis on that inclusion.
I definitely think that's the issue. I think even the most inculcated believer knows what a civil ceremony is like, knows what, you know, walking down the aisle in the white dress and all of that. But I think that the locus of importance has been placed upon, I think people are trained to look at that as cheap and unimportant, and that we have the real understanding of what's really important about getting married. And so they've put their focus on that.
And there's that elitist attitude again, right?
Yeah.
We know how it should be done. We have the truth. Everything else is substandard.
Yeah, I think that is normal coming from an organization that claims to be the one truth in the world. Yes. While it's not a healthy way to live in the world, it's. Mm-hmm. It's a natural outgrowth of that mindset, I think. Okay, so I think we've definitely covered the problems with the policy and what could change if the policy changed.
And there's a model, like we said earlier, too, before you go on, Heather, there are models from around the world, from England.
Definitely.
I'm sure those saints in England place no less importance on the temple ceremony by having a civil wedding first.
I agree. And I also think that in large parts of the world, they still have the situation that Insana was talking about back in the 60s and 70s, where temples were not ubiquitous. I mean, they're not ubiquitous all over the world. So it is more of a practical reality in other parts of the world that they just can't, you know, they can't practically get married in the temple first. So I think that they still have a practical mindset, which I think would be a valuable thing to re-import to places where this policy exists.
And I know for sure, you know, I've been told that we've been, regarding the temple wedding petition, we've been in contact with Michael Watterson, he's the PR guy for the church, and, mm-hmm. you know, and we've spoken to several people at the church office building, and we know that there are some of the higher-ups and people in those positions that are very sympathetic towards the change. as it's not a doctrine, we're not seeking a doctrinal change, we're seeking a policy change.
Right.
And I'm still hopeful that this change will happen soon.
That they will remove from the Church Handbook of Instructions the 1-year requirement.
Yes. So we're hopeful of that. We're hoping that it happens. It's just too painful of a policy to have in place in a church that constitutes itself a worldwide church. And we just need to stop the pain. It's like I said before, it's 2012, and we should not even be sitting here talking about this.
But can I inject something here, Michelle? Even yes. if they change it, even if mm-hmm. they change that policy, mm-hmm. that does, from what I gather, it's not going to stop the individual couples from making the choice
Correct.
To still have their wedding ceremony, the original first wedding ceremony, be held in the temple, which, because now there is more temples. I mean, my daughter went down to Utah from Edmonton because Edmonton didn't have a temple at the time, and I guess rather than go to somewhere in southern Alberta, they trekked off all the way to Utah. I'm not sure she would have done it any different even if she didn't have that 1-year waiting period. She may have still chosen to have her ceremony in the temple, the original ceremony, which still would have excluded me.
And some people will do that, but I can almost guarantee you that the majority of people, if I know all of my children, if they did not have that penalty hanging over their heads when they get to that age, and I were to say to my children, okay, you know, you get married, great big happy family, we're all going to be there. You're getting married on the 16th, and we're, you know, that's their wedding date. And on the very next day, you can go and do your church stuff.
They may or may not make that choice. We don't know until the time. I mean, I never thought that's my daughter right. would get married in a Mormon temple and exclude
that's
me.
Right, so. Right. But the chances that they will make a choice to include all of their family members
increase.
And their friends, it dramatically increases. And that's what we're asking for. We're asking for the choice. We're not asking that this be, you know, that it's mandated that you have to. But we're asking to give them the choice. Mm-hmm. And that's what they don't have right now.
Well, you know, something occurs to me. Part of what would change with removing the 1-year waiting period would have to be a change of the stigma of having a ceremony outside of the temple. Because Absolutely. Like I said earlier, there is this attitude that if you have a ring ceremony, you're somehow cheapening your temple marriage. So I think that might go away, but I think that there might need to be a concerted effort to remove that stigma. But that aside, mm-hmm. if the church would uncouple from, the government in the wedding process, mm-hmm. Who wants to get married at like 9 a.m? Nobody wants to get up and go to a 9 o'clock mm-hmm. wedding, right? So if they uncoupled from, you know, you have to sign your marriage certificate when you get married to the temple and just make it a purely religious covenant, then couples could get up and go to the temple, you know, like 9 o'clock in the morning, noon, whatever, have their sealing, have their church ordinances done, showing that it's, you know, the most important part of their ceremony to their God. And then later that day, go have their wedding, their civil wedding mm-hmm. with their family there. So it doesn't even, there doesn't even have to be the problem of the two dates and which one are you going to hold most sacred? Which one are you going to do your anniversary on? People could be sealed first thing in the morning or in the morning, early afternoon, have their wedding in the evening and their reception. And it would completely remove any heartache or any stigma. It would be like, kind of like kids have made prom an all day thing. You know, it used to be, you just picked up your date and went to the dance. And now it's like, you have to go skydiving and then go to lunch. And then that'd be kind of what would be done to marriage. It would be like an all day thing. And you had multiple things to do that day, which already exists with the wedding and the reception. So instead of just wedding reception, you'd have sealing, wedding reception.
Hey, Heather, have uh-huh. you ever heard of anybody that's gone ahead and done the, you know, gone and got sealed and then had a real wedding in the evening? And I mean, a civil wedding. Sorry, I didn't mean it to come out that way. And had a civil wedding in the evening. What have been the repercussions other than the little bit of social stigma that some judgmental Mormons might impose? Can something to you?
I don't think there's any policies in the church that could penalize you in any way. But I think that people have been made to believe that that is an affront to the church. It's snubbing the church. And so it's looked down upon. I don't personally know anybody that's ever done that, but I hate to admit, I saw on MTV some TV show like True Life or something where some girl was marrying a convert and it showed the pain with the son's family, and they did have a ring ceremony and she threw a big, huge tantrum about it the whole way through the whole show. She just thought it was stupid. She didn't want to do it. And then after the wedding and the ring ceremony and the reception, she expressed gratitude that they were able to do that and that she had really loved it and thought it was a great addition to her wedding day. But no, the church can definitely not penalize. I shouldn't say definitely, maybe they can, but to my knowledge, there is no, you're not sinning by having a civil ceremony after your temple ceremony. It's just really looked down upon.
Yeah. So it's just more a social thing.
So social stigma. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate, I think.
Well, what if you just didn't invite any Mormons to your civil ceremony? I'd do that. I did read about a couple, and it's long enough that I don't remember their names, but when they were told that one of the kids was a convert, and so his entire family was not allowed, and so they decided together as a couple that if this was going to be the church's policy and they still wanted to get married in the temple, that they would not allow her family to attend either, and then they would have a civil reception ceremony thing afterward that everybody got to go to. And it was kind of interesting to turn the tables on the LDS that got to suddenly find out what it feels like to be excluded from something so important. So, you know, I don't remember the name, so I can't validate, you know, whether it was just a story somebody told on Postmo. But it's an interesting idea because I think sometimes LDS people don't have a concept of how raw that pain is until something has been taken away from them, and then all of a sudden they think that they're special and they're all of a sudden the big victim when they've been doing it to others for so long.
Yeah, like you said earlier, it's hard to have that empathy when you haven't had that same treatment reciprocated.
You know, something we haven't even touched upon is that non-members and people who are no longer faithful and paying their tithing and everything are not the only people excluded from temple ceremonies. There are many, many people who don't get to have their cousins and siblings and
You know. My daughter's never gotten to see either of her siblings get married.
Because she was a teenager, right? Hadn't been endowed.
Yeah. And I, the only temple ceremony that I've been to of my own siblings, I've never been to one of my own siblings. I've been to one niece's.
Right.
But I've never seen my own siblings get married because I was one of the youngest.
Younger one. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people who are faithful members who are also being excluded simply because of age.
But they're fine with it.
That's the weird thing, right?
Because it's expected. It's become the culture, uh-huh. and you become you're just fine with it.
Yeah.
Don't you think it's weird that you get dressed up? You go to the temple as a non-member or a young member or a inactive or an unworthy mother like myself, and you get dressed up and you go early and you park and you go to this thing and you sit in that weird little room with the weird little propaganda.
Or you wait outside.
Yeah, and you wait, and then you go and you stand and you get pictures taken as if you were all there together. That is bizarre. I think that is a total weird thing that I would be embarrassed to admit as a Mormon that the people in my wedding entourage were not actually at my wedding. They were there in the building, but they weren't in the wedding.
And that's the thing about growing up in a very isolated culture where that's the status quo. It becomes your normal until somebody points it out to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until you're made aware.
Exactly. Until you're standing on the outside of it looking in.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I think we've done a good job of discussing this, the problems with this issue, and hope for changing it. To finish up the episode, I was hoping that you guys could share your own stories, because everybody that's included in this discussion, besides me, and I'm just the host, has personal experience with this. And so I'd like to give each of you the opportunity to share your experience with this problem. And Santa D, why don't you share your experiences with exclusion in the temple?
Okay. Do you mind if I just read it off of my blog?
That'd be fine.
Okay. And this I wrote quite a while ago, and I've kind of come full circle, but imagine 3 or 4 years ago when I was still raw from the pain. I called it The Unworthy. My daughter's been married for almost 5 years now, and my son for 3.5. One would think the raw wound would start to heal over and stop gushing blood at some point. I'll pretend it's not bleeding, and I'll cover it with a towel, but the issue of marriage comes along, and the tears come right back, and my stomach hurts. My hands shake, and I get that old-timey feeling of wanting to crawl under my desk and die. I left the church about 4 years before my daughter got married. When I left, I sort of peripherally knew that my time to face the music would come, but it didn't hit me too hard, even though I was suddenly off the list for the dozens of nieces and nephews' weddings. I hated every experience in the temple, and I found it suffocating, humiliating, and tedious, and very cultish. So going to the temple was never something I cherished or sought. I'd been to numerous LDS ceilings as well as my own, and they resemble all the pomp and circumstance and individuality of an automatic car wash or being the 4 billionth customer at McDonald's. There's nothing that special about the LDS ceiling ceremonies. When the folks at the Salt Lake City Temple brag that they perform 168 ceilings in one day, it should put the whole thing in perspective. Run them through, we're moving, we're walking, keep going, yeah, 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 say your vows, blah, 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 time and eternity, and you're done. Next, I've had more intimate experiences at the DMV. So when my daughter gave up her scholarship to USU and went to BYU, Idaho, I knew it was just a matter of months before she met a returned missionary and was swept off her feet and whisked into all the bliss of Mormon marriage. Sure enough, by mid-September, she'd met a nice young man, a local returned missionary from Rexburg, and by November, they were engaged, and they're perfectly suited for each other. They're very happy. They decided to get married in February, 3 months away, and that gave me time to help with the dress, the flowers, the photo, the cake, the honeymoon, and all the planning that goes into a typical low-key LDS wedding reception. We didn't discuss the actual wedding much because we both knew that I would not be allowed to attend. It was fun to help her plan, but mostly I just sent money and I worked on the reception side of the fence. I still enjoyed it, and I decided I'd break the bank to make sure it was very special and memorable. I enjoyed that part, and I'm not sorry that we made it really special. Finally, we had to face that huge elephant that was kind of crapping all over the living room, and we both cried. And I told her that even if I could convince the bishop that I was interested in being part of the church, that I could never pull it off with my family, and that they would all know that I had lied to get into the temple. I told her that it would taint the experience for her, and it would make me feel ashamed that I had succumbed to such a low-class game to be included. Many, many other parents do the same thing. She understood, and we cried and cried, but I think deep down she respected the fact that I chose, or that I could not lie like so many parents do when they're faced with that dilemma. After that conversation, I crawled under my desk and I bawled like a baby for 3 days. When the wedding day came, I was dressed up for the photos, my youngest daughter and I, and my son-in-law's grandmother, a non-Mormon, and his younger brother all sat in the little room off to the side of the temple foyer and watched the little propaganda film that they have for the visitors. We mostly just sat and whispered conversationally for the hour or so while the others went through the ceremony. When it ended, the real fecal matter started oozing. My ex walked out beaming. He was worthy. And he made sure everyone knew it. My mother had escorted my daughter through the rituals, and she was appropriately kind and condescending, which only made me loathe the experience even more. I got to be pitied and looked down upon by complete strangers who had little to do with raising my daughter, but because they could answer yes to those silly temple questions, they were invited to participate. Then we got in line for the photos. My daughter was very stressed because the photographer wasn't there, so I grabbed my wallet. I hired another photographer who was there for another wedding. My ex did not pony up with a single dollar to help, but he was the proud, beaming, worthy father of the bride. I smiled pretty. I swallowed the shame that was served to me. I hid my tears behind dark glasses. My daughter might never know that it nearly crippled me. But she had a beautiful reception, a gorgeous dress, and the day that she always dreamed about. And I got to do it all over again. A year later, when my son got married, I will most likely get to do it again in a few years if my youngest daughter gets married to an LDS man. Luckily, she's dating somebody that's not LDS. Families are forever, huh? Isn't it the sweetest thing? I have no illusions that anything of what I do or say will impact the LDS church policies or soften their hearts toward the very people that deserve their respect. The temple is a carrot that's held out as a way to extract consistent tithing from the members. Even if someone is inactive for 10 years, but their child is anticipating marriage in the temple, the parents will come back to church and pay tithing for 6 months or so before, just so they can attend. Even intermittent revenues are better than none. I paid tithing every year of my adult life and much of my youth, right up to about 3 years before my daughter got married. But even with all that I'd given, it did not make me worthy to go to the temple because I'd stopped paying and going to church before she got married. Worthy is really just a way of purchasing indulgences. As long as the church needs to extract funds from its members, they'll extort them with the twisted and cruel plot. The Italian mafia could learn some lessons from the church in shaking folks down and keeping them paying for the right to do family business in the Mormon self-proclaimed territory. It's institutionalized extortion. It isn't a cult, it's a criminal venture. Anyway, there you go.
I don't know what to say about your story. That's incredibly painful.
It's not just me. It happens to people every single day.
Yeah, and I think you express it quite well. Can we go ahead and have Truth share her experience about being excluded from a temple wedding?
Okay, I'd also like to just read what I wrote for the petition website.
Go for it.
This is not an easy story to tell, for it rips my heart, weighs heavy on my chest, and brings tears rushing each time I think about it, let alone talk about it. I was married at the time I became pregnant. Incidentally, I was married on this day, the day we're talking here, the 23rd of June. 9 months later, and 21 hours of hard labor to give birth to my one and only child, a darling daughter. When she was only a toddler, 1 year old, her father and I separated and subsequently divorced. Through the years, I was the one who loved, fed, clothed, comforted, educated, encouraged, supported, and at times disciplined her, all the while working to keep a roof over our heads, food in our bellies, and clothes on our backs. The buck stopped with me. Through no fault of hers, her father was an absent one who she finally was able to reconnect with when she turned 18. Much to my surprise, sometime during her college years, she stumbled upon the Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I, not being a follower of organized religion, did some research, and although not convinced this was a path suited to my high-spirited, intelligent, creative, talented, educated only child, I supported her right to choose her path and destiny. From the age of 3, she was a dancer, actress, musician, and singer, and I had the pleasure of making every one of her costumes, so I assumed I would also have the pleasure of helping design and make her wedding dress. Imagine the horror I felt as a mother to discover that I would not only not be able to attend her wedding or have any significant role in her life from that day forward. I had not encountered that tidbit of information during the research of this path she had chosen. To me, a wedding is about two families coming together to celebrate the joining of two young people in love about to venture out into the world together, but still needing some guidance and support from those who love them. It is about standing up and being counted to support and encourage them, not just on that day, but for the duration of the marriage. When that day is marred by the idea that some are not worthy, my soon-to-be returning missionary son-in-law actually said those words to me, to attend the joining, it sets up a whole set of unspoken and sometimes spoken hierarchies, which even time, love, and support cannot overcome. It is exclusive and divisive rather than inclusive. So in my opinion, this particular practice is clearly not about families. When I suggested to my daughter that she be married in the church first so that all of her relatives and friends could attend, she responded that then she wouldn't be able to be sealed for 1 year and that would not be a good thing. This clearly put me between a rock and a hard place, for I had raised her to respect and adhere to the rules and regulations of any organization she belonged to. How, without being a hypocrite, could I possibly insist on her going against one of the clearly most sacred rituals of her chosen path? So out of respect for an institution which clearly does not respect the parent-child bond, I stepped aside and gave them my support and love, which I continued to do so. But given that now I am banished from their lives, it is clear that their belief system does not reciprocate that respect. Maybe, just maybe, if we had come together as a family to plan and celebrate this union, it would have strengthened our relationship. This ritual and others teaches and encourages disrespect and alienation of those who have different beliefs, which then contributes to division and discord rather than unity and harmony. And I still believe that.
Well, I think it's very well written. Michelle, would you like to share your experiences with exclusion in the temple?
I've already shared some of mine here. But, you know, and I won't do that again. But I just want to say that I'm the mother of 4 children. Just listening to insanities, pain, and truths, truth story and the pain she experiences. I'm hoping that's it's not a foreshadowing for me. I consider myself a strong woman. I'm a strong Black woman, and my children belong to a church that once excluded their ancestors from being full participants in a lot of their ceremonies and a lot of their ordinances. And like I said, I'm a strong Black woman, but I think that if my kids were to grow up and be Mormon and were to choose at that time, for no fault of their own, I will recognize that. It's the indoctrination. I completely blame the indoctrination and the teachings of the church for all these so-called choices that they're given. But if they were to choose to exclude me from such an important day in their lives, I don't know that I would be able to handle that very well. And so this is why right now, and there are a lot of people who, like Insanity said, you just show up and you grin and bear it, but it breaks you. It breaks your heart to have to be the one who's, you know, you're the parent, you're the one who raised them. It breaks your heart to have to be the one who's singled out, who's being unworthy, an unworthy mother, when you've been loving to your children all these years. And that would really hurt me, and I hope it's not a foreshadowing for me. A lot of people are experiencing that pain right now, and the sooner that this policy change is implemented, the sooner we can start to heal, and the sooner we can start to promote a family, a truly family-oriented church. And it's time for the the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to step up to the plate and to reflect what they're teaching. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
This, the temple exclusion, does not have to define the future of our relationship with our adult children. And it's a painful part of the division, but we have the rest of their lives and our lives to be good parents and grandparents and to love them and to move beyond that two-hour experience that humiliated and hurt us. And it's been hard. It's been really hard, but I have worked every single time I communicate with my kids to make sure that they know that I'm always their mother, that my love is not conditional. They don't have to comply with a bunch of arbitrary rules to have my support and affection and love. And they don't invite me to baby blessings and religious ritual things like that, but I have the rest of their lives to be their mom and their grandma. And they know that they can count on me for the really tough stuff. When their heart is broken, or when they're financially stressed, or when all the things that every other parent across the world works through their children with, it's just not the Mormon thing. We let that one alone. And sometimes you just have to see a bigger picture than the Mormon church allows you to look at. You have to have I want to call it a more celestial vision of your children than this very limited, narrow perspective that the church wants us to live among our families.
You know, I think that's a really great way to end. Although I do want to say that I think it's sad that, a sad reality that you have to be the one to, you know, to set aside the pain and, build that bridge, and rather than it being a two-way street, do you know what I mean? Like, you constantly have to be the one to be the bigger person. And I think that's sad, and I wish that could change, but I really appreciate you, sharing that.
But even when you're the bigger person and you want to bridge that gap, it doesn't always happen either, because it's great for Aunt Santa, and I think it's really wonderful that she has a relationship with her children and grandchildren. But in my case, my daughter deemed that I wasn't worthy enough to be the grandmother of her children, because I am not Mormon, nor do I don't meet her criteria of what a grandmother should be now based on.
But you know what, Insana, that's awesome what you said. It's great that you're trying to, that you've bridged that gap, but you're also not laying down and being silent about it. And about what has happened. And I think that for too long, a lot of people have just quietly just walked away.
My real name isn't Insana.
I know.
I'm on here as a pseudonym, and I think it's a cowardly move. And it isn't because I'm trying to protect my kids, it's trying to protect my very naive, sweet mother.
Yes, and we understand that. But you are speaking out, and you're being a voice for those who can't do that, who are afraid to, who for so many years have said, okay, this is the way it is. I'm going to walk away with this pain, and I'm not going to say anything. And I think a lot of times, you know, when people are silent, then things are allowed to keep happening. There's no change in the status quo. And by speaking out against it, by bringing to people's awareness, because a lot of people are not, outside of Mormonism, are not aware that this is happening. You mention it, I mention it to people, and they look at me like, okay, I don't believe you. Like, are you, you know, and their immediate response is, well, that's wrong. Are you sure? And I went around to people's doors for this petition, to ask them to sign the petition. And everybody that I asked, about 30 people, 30 doors I went to, I got 29 signatures. Most of these people weren't aware that this was happening. And so it's very important that we bring the issue out there. If we could get this issue on a national level and say, hey, look, this is what is happening in your own country, to your parents, to your grandparents, to your dads, to your sisters, to your moms, then putting that light on the issue will somehow hopefully help to kind of bring about the change. It will be a factor in it. And so I think it's great that we're here, that we're speaking out, and that we're trying to just bring awareness.
I personally think, and this is fairly cynical, that the only way, the only reason that the LDS Church ever changes its policy on such things, you know, as civil rights or the way they mistreat others is when their financial tax exemption is threatened. And that, to me, is the only way that they would respond to this, because it's too big a moneymaker for them.
But if it starts sowing enough dissension in the ranks that it threatens believers, I mean, it causes an opening for believers to walk away, that might be a way they view it as well. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And it will call, you know, like we said, it's a missionary church. And so the more people that are aware that this is happening, the more parents that are aware, the more college students that are aware that, hey, if I become a Mormon, you know, and decide to follow their rules, my parents are not going to be able to be, yeah, like if it becomes that, then it goes back to the money there in Santa, because yeah. they're not going to get those converts. Parents are going to be more adamant and more equipped.
Oh yeah. If I had known when my daughter joined what I know today, I would
Absolutely.
Have like kidnapped her, taken her off to some retreat somewhere in some island and have her deprogrammed. Seriously, I would have. I wouldn't have been
yes.
so nonchalant about letting her follow her destiny.
Absolutely. That's the thing. So it will affect their bottom line. The more information, the more knowledge that people have about all these issues, then the church has got to be able to follow that and see that, hey, you know, Let's be more friendly. Let's be more open. Let's spread more goodwill so that we can get more members. More members means more tithing money for generations to come. So it's an important issue.
I agree.
Okay.
I don't think you're convinced in Santa.
I don't think my opinion matters a twat to anything.
Well.
I just don't think that it has any value, especially for the LDS Church, but it has value to when I'm preaching to the choir.
Yes.
It has value to
yes.
other people.
Absolutely.
I'd like to thank you guys for sharing your stories. I think that they show the profound impact that this policy has and the damage that it does, and why it's so important that it change. I'd like to thank you guys for joining me on this discussion today. And as we say on Mormon Expression, the conversation will continue at MormonExpression.com. Thanks, everybody.